Hello, and welcome to episode 8 of series 4 of the Engaging Internal Comms podcast. This is the show for employee engagers and internal communicators who like to keep up to date with all that is new in our profession. My name's Craig Smith from The Big Picture People. I'm going to keep today's introduction pretty brief. Just a quick introduction to what we're going to be covering in the next couple of episodes, just to give you a bit of a preview. So in 2 weeks' time, on the 25th of April, we've got an interview with Stefan Widener. Stefan is from a company called Numi, and he's going to be telling us all about the importance of psychological safety in our communications in a messy world. So that's all about how we can help create psychological safety and our role in doing that as employee engagers and internal communicators. And then after that, on the 9th of May, I have an interview with Lena Scullard from LMS Productions. And Lena's going to be telling us all about the importance of responsive versus reactive communications. And we're explaining the difference between the two in that session. And Lena's specialism is in cognitive behavioral psychology. So there's a strong link there to some topics that you may not have come across before. So I think you'll find that really interesting. The final thing I just wanted to point out today, today's interview, we actually have an infographic that we've done. One of our graphic illustrators here at The Big Picture People, Liam, has illustrated the whole podcast episode as a one-pager, which you can actually download from the show notes. So if you're not listening to this on if you're listening to this on iTunes, you need to head across to the Big Picture People website, and where you find bigpicturepeople.co.uk, so you can find it. And if you head across there, you'll find on the podcast episode if you go to the show notes and the actual episode itself and scroll down, you'll see there is a PDF that you can download. So it's a one-page visual summary of everything that we covered in today's podcast, which I think you'll hopefully find useful, and you'll find the one pager useful as a reminder of what we've covered. If you're having any difficulty finding that as well, you can go to engagingic.com, and that will take you to the same web page. You just need to find this episode. So episode 8 of series 4 of the podcast, and if you find that, you can just scroll down the page. If you click on the actual infographic, which is embedded in the show notes, it'll open up a page where you can get it as a downloadable PDF. Anyway, as I said, I'm going to keep things short. I hope that was short enough. So we'll get straight on to this episode's interview. We've probably all experienced in our lives the phenomena of starting something and not finishing it. I know I have personally, both in my personal life, in my business life, lots of things, ideas that I've had and written down and started with a great gusto and enthusiasm and never actually finished. And some people we probably know in our lives are more prone to that, and others who seem to be better at finishing things off. So our guests in this episode are going to be telling us all about the science behind why we don't finish what we start, and how that is related to much more fundamental issues within our organization when it comes to employee engagement and our willingness to see things through, both in our careers, but also in our work as well, within the tasks that we perform. So we're going to be finding out all about this phenomenon known as swipe, which is what their book is called. It's the analogy is when we are looking at something on our iPads or our phones or our smart devices, this idea where we swipe to one side to get rid of something is something that we do in our lives when we come across things that are more difficult than we expected or are going to take more time than we expected. And that's both individually and collectively. I guess we can all relate to the challenges with our organizations of projects that take a lot longer to finish than we ever thought and get abandoned by the organization, and the cynicism that can generate within our organizations amongst the people, that we start things and with great fanfare and gusto, and we never actually finish them. So that's what we're going to be exploring in this episode. We're going to be talking about the phenomena of not finishing what we start and how we can avoid that, and what are some of the things that we need to have within our organizations, and also that we need to take personal responsibility for when it comes to making sure that we see things through, that we don't just quit when we find the going gets tough. So I hope you enjoy this interview. It's quite a long interview, but very, very good, and with two great guests who have collaborated extensively over the last few years and are sharing their insights with us. So I hope you enjoy it. My guests today are Tracy Maylett and Tim Vanderhey. Tracy is the CEO, organizational psychologist, and researcher and speaker and university professor. He advises leaders throughout the world on employee engagement and organizational effectiveness. Tim is a journalist, columnist, and New York Times best-selling ghostwriter for more than 65 non-fiction books for genres such as business, finance, advice, outdoor adventure, religion, memoir, parenting, and health. Together, Tracy and Tim have written the book Swipe, The Science Behind Why We Don't Finish What We Start, which is all about why we give up on our goals and why we disengage when the going gets tough. So, hello, gentlemen. How are you?
Well, thank you. It's good to be with you, Craig.
Fantastic.
You're great.
Yeah. So, let's start with you, Tracy. Tracy, whereabouts in the world are you based and where are you speaking from at the moment?
I'm located in the state of Utah in the United States, in a beautiful place in the Rocky Mountains that was just south of Salt Lake City, Utah.
Fantastic. And Tim, where are you?
I am in the United States. I'm in Kansas City in the state of Missouri, which means I'm going to take a little victory lap and tout my Super Bowl winning Chiefs.
Ah, yeah. I was actually in the States when I actually watched the Super Bowl real time for the first time in US time rather than watching it in the UK and very late in the evening. But yeah, it was interesting. Lots of people were interesting, even when I was in Las Vegas, and there were some people wandering around with Kansas shirts on, and yeah, interesting, good game as well. I enjoyed it. I enjoyed watching it.
It was a great game, and I had someone ask me, a guy I know from Philadelphia. He said, "So how much damage did your fans do after the Chiefs won?" I said, "We're not Philadelphia. We don't burn cars here when our team." It was an opportunity to throw down a little smack, you know.
Anyway, fantastic. So, what would be good, guys, is just to find out. We'll talk about the book because that's kind of what we're going to be talking about today. We're going to be talking about why we don't finish what we start, and I think that's a phenomenon that we can all probably relate to in our lives. But start with you, Tracy. Tracy, you want to tell me a little bit about how and the listeners how you've ended up doing what you're doing now, and a little bit about your background, and expand a little bit on what I said in the intro about the work you're currently doing.
I'd be happy to. Yeah, Craig, I never set out to be an author, nor did I set out to be a CEO. They just kind of came, and I'm grateful for those opportunities. What really fascinated me was the way people behave in organizations. I began studying that, began focusing on that, and that's the real purpose of our practice. How do people behave? How do people experience an organization? So my education is centered in that, and I've been doing this for the last about 25 years, and really focuses on what makes an individual show up, both mentally, physically, spiritually, emotionally, in the things that they do. What causes them to dedicate what they do to that? So I've really dedicated the vast majority of my research, the vast majority of my teaching, and also our business practice to that focus. What causes somebody to be really present in what they do?
Excellent. Thank you. Very good. Very good summary. And Tim, tell me a little bit about your work and maybe also to how you and Tracy got together and got to work on this project that we're going to be talking about.
Sure. Love to. Well, I mean, in the same vein as Tracy, I had never set out to be a ghostwriter. That's, you know, my primary job. Something I fell into accidentally when I first went freelance, which was, good Lord, 28 years ago now. Just was asked one day by one of my clients to write a book for him. And I said, sure, I can do that. And then I hung up the phone and said, oh, dear God, how do you write a book? which is just, that's what you do, right? You say yes to things and then you have a mild panic attack and you figure it out. But since then, I've written, as you said, you know, more about somewhere around, it's not an exact count because I've lost count myself, somewhere around 65 nonfiction books for all kinds of people, for big publishers, for small publishers, all kinds of different subjects and working with fascinating people. It's a great career. Tracy and I came together, was it 2014?
Maybe even earlier than that. I thought you were going to start with, it was a beautiful summer evening or something along those lines.
Nah, I could say, I was born the son of a sharecropper or something. That wouldn't be true. We started working together, like maybe it was 2013, and Tracy was a ghostwriting client, and he and one of his, One of his colleagues at DecisionWise wanted to write their first book about employee engagement. Mm. And so I was fortunate enough to team up with them to work on that book. It was a great experience. We wrote another book together called The Employee Experience. The first one was called Engagement Magic. Mm. The second one was called The Employee Experience. And then those both books did pretty well. I mean, they won, the first one won an award. Mm. The second one made an independent bestseller list. And so that started a relationship that's continued to this day.
Yeah. And you've got immersed, obviously, in this area as well. You know, you've not just been working on this as a pair of hands. You're fully engaged with this topic area as well, given the kind of the books that you've already worked on together, I guess, and culminating in the one that you're just publishing now. Yeah.
Absolutely. It's an interesting topic. Mm. I mean, aside from the content of Swipe, it's just an interesting topic to ask why people choose to engage or disengage. In things. I've obviously don't have anywhere near Tracy's level of expertise. Learned a lot.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Excellent. So we're going to talk about the book Swipe in a moment. Just before we do that, I just want to talk a little bit about this phenomena, which I talk about quite a lot. In fact, I was working with a client yesterday and I referenced it with forgetting that we actually were going to be talking about it today as well. This idea of quitting and staying, and obviously this is highly relevant in the field of engagement. So Tracy, maybe do you want to talk a little bit about what that is and what it looks like and why we should be worried about it?
You know, we're seeing a lot of press over the last little while about the Great Resignation and various terminology that basically means the same thing. Mm-hmm. It is the idea of people leaving organizations. But the most dangerous piece is those people who are physically still with the organization but have mentally checked out. Mm-hmm. And we call that concept quitting and staying. We all know the individual who retired 5 years ago but forgot to tell anybody that that was the case. They continue to show up for work, but they're not doing a whole lot. Mm-hmm. You know, the idea of engagement, we use the term engagement to mean an emotional state where people feel energetic and committed to their work. And in return, they're willing to invest their best selves, their hearts, their spirits, their minds, and their hands in what they do.
Yeah.
Now, when people remain physically with an organization but don't bring the rest of that to the organization, we call that phenomenon quitting and staying. Mm. And, you know, within that, What we've been focusing on, by we, I mean the royal we here, we've been focusing as organizations on how do we create engagement in an organization? What can we do to engage somebody? We get a lot of clients who come to us and say, we need help in engaging our team. And the reality of that is that engagement is really a 50-50 proposition. What that means is that the organization can plant the seed of engagement and till the soil and nourish it, but really, it's up to the employee to make that choice of whether or not he or she chooses to engage in that organization. Mm. And that's really what started this whole concept of where we focus on employee engagement. What is the organization's part? What can they do to till that soil? And the second part of that is equally important. And that's really kind of the basis of where we started on this book. What is the employee's role in engaging in that organization?
Mm, yeah. I don't know what it's like in the States. And we were talking about this yesterday with a client I was at, but there's a real challenge, I think, certainly in the UK, and I see this a lot, is with organizations, particularly in some of sort of more sort of public sector, not necessarily public, all public sector, but particularly ones where there are really kind of favorable, kind of pension and terms and benefits, and people are like almost trapped in this cycle of, you know, I don't want to quit because I've got that great package and, you know, and I'll be throwing away a fantastic retirement package. And at the same time, I'm just completely emotionally disengaged with the work and I'm just having to drag myself out of bed to come into every day. I don't know. And again, that's a massive generalization, but is that a phenomenon that you're familiar with in the States and in other work that you've done around the globe?
Well, it certainly is. The organization really is kind of doing their part as far as, you know, the salaries and compensation and things along these lines. They may not be providing some of these other things that really do create engagement in somebody's life. But you pointed out something very important. It's that it's a choice. It's an individual's choice of whether or not he or she chooses to engage. Mm. And that goes beyond just public service.
Yeah.
It goes into any organization today.
Yeah. 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 Absolutely. Absolutely. So, let's talk about the book then, because we referenced that, and I know they kind of set the context now around that concept of quitting and staying and how it fits in with the book. So I don't know whether Tim, where you want to lead off on this and talk a little bit about the name of the book, Swipe, and how that came about, and the kind of metaphor that embodies.
Sure, absolutely. So Tracy and I initially got together to talk about this book the beginning of 2020, which, you know, seems like an age ago now, before COVID shut the world down, really. Mm. And at the time, we were talking about a third book in sort of our trilogy of engagement. And it was going to be, as Tracy's mentioned, about the other side of the engagement equation, how to get employees to choose to engage. And as we were batting around ideas and just brainstorming and coming up with concepts and things, we landed on this idea, both in terms, both linguistically, of a single word, you know, the word swipe. I mean, single word titles and single word concepts are always great because they're easily understood and easily remembered. And we hit on this idea, well, you know, can we plausibly talk about swiping on a smart device as an analogy for disengaging, for choosing to what we call reality switch, which, you know, when you're on your phone or your tablet or something, and you're having an experience that's unsatisfactory or frustrating or whatever, it's very easy just to, with a flick of your finger or a tap of the tap of an app icon to change your experience. And, you know, the research that we did found that yes, our engagement with devices, I mean, we're so deep, you know, they're practically umbilically connected to us now, has changed how we perceive the physical world. The shorthand that I use, that has certainly happened to me 100 times, and I know from the recognition laugh that I get from people has happened to other people as well, is the example of when you go from writing on a keyboard or typing on a phone to writing in the longhand, the old-fashioned way, with a pencil or a pen on a yellow pad or something, and you make a mistake. And I know I've done this 1,000 times. Instinctively, just for a split second, you look for the undo function.
Yeah.
And I do it, and I chuckle at myself and go, oh, dope. It's not, you know, it's just a yellow pad. It's not your computer. And then you erase what you, or cross out what you wrote, and you keep going. But it's that instinct that's been programmed into us now by technology that we can, you know, really that says to us, well, maybe physical reality is just as malleable as digital reality. And so we thought about that. We thought that is a great metaphor for the idea of disengaging at work. Because I can just say, I'm not happy. The job's too hard. This is putting me out of my comfort zone. I'm going to swipe my mental finger and leave this job, either literally leave or check out and quit and stay.
Yeah.
And so that we thought, okay, well, I think that's our book. That's great. Hooray. We have a concept now. We can start thinking about writing. Only later on, and I think it was in the summer, because I was working outside a lot, and I called Tracy during it was the summer of COVID after things had shut down, and I was working in my backyard most of the time, and said, I said, you know, I think maybe this is a bigger book than just about employee engagement. And we talked back and forth, and we agreed that, this was a phenomenon that was universal to nearly everyone in terms of not finishing what you start. Part of the state of being human is to have aspirations and have goals that we maybe we're not ready for, or are too big for us now, or that we pursue for reasons other than desire, you know, social pressure or things like that. And so that became, we realized this is a bigger book than just what we initially set out to write. And it became Swipe. It became a book for basically anyone who's ever finished tried to finish something and quit partway through.
Okay, excellent. And I'd like to sort of talk about how the book kind of got into that area, and then, but also sort of to explore that phenomena as well in and of itself, because I think, as I said at the beginning, I think that's something we can all relate to. I think our lives are littered with, you know, tangible and intangible, half finished and incomplete projects, and I know some people have a tendency to be more prone to that sort of thing. So what's some of the science behind that? And again, you know, maybe just exploring some of the ideas that you've got in the book around not finishing things that we start. Why is that so prevalent? Why is that something that we can all relate to as human beings, do you think?
I appreciate you bringing up the concept of the science. That's the subtitle of the book, The Science Behind Why We Don't Finish What We Start. And this book truly is based on science rather than just anecdotal data or speculation. It involves a couple of different areas. One is neuroscience. So our bodies, our minds are physically equipped or mal-equipped to really disengage in what's in front of us. So we have two fighting forces. One of these forces is the natural desire that each one of us has to engage. Mm. So we see a lot of sitcoms today, and any show that's written about what happens in the office is about employees trying to disengage as quickly as they can. Mm. And we find that humorous. But the reality is none of us ever will show up to work with the idea that I sure hope today sucks the life out of me. That's not who we are as human beings. So we have that natural desire to engage in what we do. But we have this opposing force, and that is that our minds are extraordinarily susceptible to distraction. So when we get what's in front of us, let's suppose we look at this as scientist Daniel Kahneman looks at this, and he says that there are two minds that we possess, two systems of our brain. System one is a system that is very short-term focused, and what that means is this is the system that's immediately reactive. It's reflexive. So when we're driving down the road and something runs in front of us, our mind, that piece of our mind immediately makes the decision for us. We don't have to stop and think about it. The other portion of our mind is more contemplative. That's what he calls system two. And the idea behind that is that we have to stop and think about it. It takes effort. So the concept behind the swipe here is that you have these opposing forces that are always there. They're always fighting for which dominates. And when we come up to a situation that becomes uncomfortable or unknown or is a very quick acting decision, what happens is that piece of our brain that's not really making the conscious decision takes over. So the basis of the swipe is really that concept that what happens is when we're faced with the uncomfortable, the natural reaction we have is to move to something more comfortable. That's the notion of the swipe. And that permeates every aspect of our lives. But what has happened here is that while we've become conditioned to move to something different, something less comfortable, or more comfortable, what happens is our brains have become used to doing that. So we have become, instead of masters at learning how to play the piano or masters at our jobs or masters at a particular sport, we've not put that effort into practicing. Instead, what we become masters of is the swipe. We become very accustomed to becoming a master of moving on. And that's really what this book is about. How do I stop that from when it happens?
Yeah, and it's interesting when you say that. I mean, it reminds me of a couple of sort of my own thoughts on that, which is, you know, I guess there's a whole thing in there around, you know, I think it's Dumbledore in Harry Potter says that nothing in life that is worth doing is easy. And I think there's an element of that, isn't it? There's a little path of least resistance. And then it also reminds me of... I think it's his name's completely slips my mind now. Another author who talks about that what is comfortable isn't always safe, and particularly in the world at the moment, there's a lot of people sticking to their comfort zones, but that isn't necessarily a safe place to be because you rapidly become obsolete if all you do is sit in your comfort zone. Another thing it reminds me of is that a phenomena that I see, and I guess this extrapolates not just down to an individual level but an organizational level, of how many organizations that I work with and come across who have half finished projects that they've never really fully either implemented or, you know, kind of told everybody that they're not doing that anymore. And that leads to a huge amount of confusion and distracted energy in organizations as well. So does this concept of swiping, obviously you get it at an individual level, but I guess we see that culturally in some organizations as well. Is that something that you've covered in the book or something that you've seen in your career as well?
Yeah, we're seeing two pieces result here. One is the idea that when I go in and talk to somebody or an organization, they say, we're really good at firefighting. You're an organization that fights fires very quickly, respond very quickly. And I have to look at that and say, you're not an organization of firefighters. You're an organization of arsonists.
Yeah.
You're the ones creating this difficulty.
Yeah. Yeah.
And organizations today, the second piece of that is organizations today have become so, they have attention deficit disorder.
I agree.
They move on before they actually let something to come to fruition because it's much easier just to move on.
Yeah, yeah, I agree. I use the same analogy of attention deficit disorder. And I always say, you know, whenever I work with clients and we do the kind of start, stop, continue, the always the shortest list is the stop. There's never anything never gets, that's kind right. of, we've got to keep that one on the back burner because we may need it at some point. And it's like, no, just give it a good burial and move on and forget about it and tell everybody we're not doing it anymore. And they seem frightened to do that. We've talked a bit about the conscious and the subconscious mind. The conscious and the unconscious mind in swiping. So is it as simple as one is working on the as you said, the sort of the immediate short term priorities, whereas the unconscious mind is the one that can be working on some of these unfinished projects, or is that too simplistic?
When we look at it from a neurological perspective, that's exactly what's happening. And it's the reflexive piece of our minds that are making those decisions rather than the stop and thinking about it piece. What this book is about is making that unconscious reaction or that reflex, making that conscious.
Okay.
Stopping and realizing that what I'm doing here is swiping. And Tim has developed some really very interesting analogies of how that whole piece works when we move from the unconscious to the conscious in making that decision.
Okay, Tim, do you want to share some of those analogies with us? Because I think that's always a useful way to get people to understand these ideas.
I'm going to have to refresh my memory, Tracy.
Yeah, when we were talking about... One of the pieces that we use in the book here, and Tim and I have had some fun with this one, is the concept of the click, the remote control.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Okay. So actually this was based on a not very good Adam Sandler movie from, I forget what year. sorry, I just had a brain fog there for a second. but it's very apt. And it was a movie that came out and disappeared pretty quickly about a guy who was given essentially a magical TV remote where he could essentially fast forward through the parts of his life that he found uncomfortable. You know, the parts that, you know, that we all kind of have to sort of grit our teeth and bear, like, you know, the uncomfortable conversation with your son about using a condom or, you know, whatever. You know, throughout the movie, he chooses to fast forward through a lot of those difficult parts of his life, the parts that make him uncomfortable, the parts that make him squirm. I mean, you know, everything from illness of his father and things like that. And he gets to the end of his life and realizes that those were the parts that had all the meaning and had all the growth and had all the beauty, even though they were difficult, and that he has, chosen to bypass them all. So, you know, it's a nice, neat little metaphor in a not very good movie about, that the growth and the change really come in the difficulty. What's the saying for, I forget the movie, but it's the hard that makes it great.
Yeah. Yeah. I like that. Yeah. Cause I think you're right. I think it is. It's very easy to, you know, kind of avoid that, those more challenging, not just in the, you know, in the context of the movie, but those of our life, isn't it? And working life.
And, you know, there's a really interesting dynamic that we haven't really talked about this. We didn't talk about this in the book, at all, but I think it's worth talking about, in some venue, and may as well do it here. And that is the fact that we've gone through, the entire world has gone through an uncontrolled 3-year experiment in how we get what we want and how that changed. I mean, you know, if you think about human behavior, a great deal of human behavior revolves around what do I want and how do I get what I want? Now, how do I determine what I want and how do I get it? And, you know, through COVID, the entire structure, the entire system of what do we want and how do we get it completely changed. And so much of that, so much of desire and acquisition comes into play with the swipe, because, you know, if things are too easy, we don't grow. If things are too difficult, we're paralyzed. And suddenly here comes a situation where on one hand, we're trapped at home, we can't work, etc. But on the other hand, everything shows up at our doorstep. You know, all the things that we want and need show up at our doorstep, assuming we have the wherewithal to pay for them and hire DoorDash or whatever. I'm not sure what services you have in the UK, but DoorDash and Postmates and all that stuff. And so I think that upended a great deal of the, and I'm not just pointing the finger at young people either, at Gen Z or anything. It upended a lot of the not just the thinking, but the emotions around getting what I want.
And
there's a sense, I think now, and I think we've seen this in the Great Resignation as well, of almost too much abundance and too much ease. You know, I mean, here in the States, there's still probably two jobs for every applicant.
Yeah.
So it's very easy to say, well, I'm not happy with my current role. Rather than tough it out, which I think would have been a very common, very acceptable response a few years back. Now it's, well, I can, not only can I leave and probably get another job very quickly, although I'm not sure that's true in Silicon Valley after the bank failures of the last week. But not only can I get another job quickly, but I can just as easily do the gig economy. I can run three different side hustles. You know, technology has empowered all of that as well. So I think, you know, after COVID, there's been a much stronger sense of almost being, I'm entitled to be able to move on from anything that's not comfortable for me, whether that's a relationship or a work situation or anything else, and have something that's almost custom fitted for me to be comfortable.
Yeah.
If that makes sense.
It does.
I mean, I think that abundance of ease, that overabundance of ease, it hurts our resilience. And it denies us the chance to grow through difficulty. So I think the aftermath of COVID is very interesting because, you know, you're seeing companies try to get back to a more normal, you know, pre-COVID normal, everyone in the office, and a lot of resistance. You know, for every Goldman Sachs that says, well, if you don't want to come back to the office, you're fired. There are a lot of organizations that are capitulating now and saying, okay, we get it. You want to be hybrid. You don't have to come, but you can come 3 days a week and be home too, or whatever their solution is. And I think just they're starting to realize now that there may not be any going back anytime soon from that sense that, well, I want reality customized just like I want it to be. Why can't I have that?
Yeah. I agree. And I mean, I've seen it, you know, I agree with you. I think the kind of, you know, the instant gratification element of that side of the pandemic. And you know, it's been a kind of a thing that it's been creeping into people's psyche. But I remember going back, you know, I'm going back sort of 15, 20 years when I worked in manufacturing. I remember it was always really difficult to get new graduates to come in and work. The kind of apprenticeship you really needed to do, which was working on shifts, you know, to kind of really understand people and manage people, you had to be able to manage people in difficult situations and, you know, working people who work on a night shift and all of those sorts of things. It was a great foundation in actually dealing with, you know, less complex and less sort of maybe demanding sides of the job, but later on in your career. And there were a lot of people who, I don't want to work night shift. You know, I've just come out of university. I've got the brain the size of a planet. I've got all these qualifications. I don't want to be working on night shift. And actually selling that to them as, yeah, but you're going to learn. So, you know, no, I don't want to be working night six, you know, sort of 10 o'clock at night to six o'clock, 6 a.m. in the morning. And now that was 20 years ago. So I, you know, again, I'm not hitting on like you, you know, not hitting on younger. I think equally, you know, my generation is equally culpable in that, in not wanting to put in the hard yards sometimes when we know we should do, but there's an easier, there's a path of less resistance that, you know, feels the right one to take. And I think
And if you think about something else, I mean, this is unique. This is sort of unique to my experience because my wife is an educator and she has talked for a long time about the decline in interest in trade and vocational schools in this country. And one of the things that cropped up for me when I looked into that was the not the loss, but the reduction in interest in the concept of being a journeyman, being an apprentice, you know, because if you get into, and there's a huge need for skilled tradespeople, and, you know, they do very, very well. I had an electrician out here at my house last week. He cost a bloody fortune. He was a master electrician. Guy had been in the business for 25 years. He knew his stuff. You know, and I asked him, I said, you must make a really good living. He said, yeah, but, you know, it took me 20 years to get there.
Yeah.
And there's, you know, there the concept of apprenticeship and being a journeyman and learning slowly over time from someone, you know, from a mentor, from an experienced mentor, it's the same, it's all of a piece. It's all, you know, valuing the process and valuing, you know, going through the steps, going through the motions and taking time to reach a certain, you know, to reach a certain goal or a certain destination that doesn't seem to be as appealing now. There's a huge need for vocational technical students, for instance, the vocational technical education, and very low interest in it because it's not, everybody wants to be, you know, to work in Silicon Valley or they want instant wealth. That's what, so there's, yeah, there is an instant gratification piece, I think, to the psychology of the swipe. It's not necessarily motivated by instant gratification, but the impulses are very similar in which it's, you know, it, the essence of the goals that people take on when that they inevitably, not inevitably, but eventually quit are their goals that typically require long-term persistence and discipline. You know, they're writing a first novel or getting in shape or saving money for retirement or anything like that. These are things that play out over sometimes months, sometimes years. And it takes a certain amount of discipline to say, I am going to see this through over the long term. And when you aren't able to do that, that's where the swipe comes into play. And you say, you know, this is not worth it. I'm not getting the results I want. They're not coming fast enough. And you just walk away from it. And I think that's, you know, that. So I think all of that is kind of wrapped up in each other, this instant gratification combined with just this desire to have, you know, to, if I don't see results fast enough, I'm going to swipe.
Yeah. We've talked about the phenomena. Let's talk a little bit about, you know, some of the ideas in your book and around how we can start to address this. So I think we get it now. So I know you, when we spoke originally, and I don't know if this is out of context, we talked about your an acronym, the MAGIC, magic acronym, but also any other ideas that you can summarize from the book. That kind of give us a flavor for what are some of the things we can do to address this phenomenon that we've just been talking about.
Yeah, and by the way, Tim, for me throwing you under the bus, that was a pretty solid response. Thank you.
I live under the bus, man. I have two teenagers. It's my home.
That's what it's all about. It's just wiping away from that one. Yeah, I get it. Another analogy that I absolutely love that Tim uses is being a writer. He understands this fully. All the people who come to him, the would-be authors, and he refers to this as page one energy. When I'm writing that first page, I'm excited. I have that energy. And then all of a sudden I realize on page 10, this is a lot harder than I thought it was going to be. And so we see a lot of that happening. And I love that term, page one energy. We find that in that's one of the reasons why we decided to take this book beyond employee engagement and really focus on overall engagement. And in doing so, we found We researched 50 million employee survey responses. So that's DecisionWise's database, 50 million employee survey responses, largest of its kind, and found some really interesting things. We found that there were really five keys that when these keys were present in whatever we're doing, we tend to engage in what it is. And when those aren't present to the degree to which we want those present, we will disengage in what's in front of us. Now, that could be the workplace, that could be my family, that could be a hobby, that could be whatever the case is. But those five keys form the acronym MAGIC, M-A-G-I-C. And the first one of those is meaning. When the work or what I do, what's in front of me has purpose beyond just the job itself or beyond just the task itself, I find meaning in what I do when I engage. So if I find meaning in my work, there's a reason or purpose behind it. I find meaning in my family. I find meaning in my community. I find meaning in writing this book. I will engage in that, and I will not disengage. The second piece is autonomy. Autonomy is not anarchy or chaos. It's Tim and I like to use another analogy, which is jazz. You know, we're both jazz musicians. The idea that within jazz music and music in general, we have a structure. The structure is in place. You know, jazz, it's, you know, 12 bars, and we have these certain keys that we can operate within, and this time signature, et cetera. And as long as we operate within that, we have the freedom to choose how we do that. So autonomy is similar to that, in that we are free to bring ourselves and our talents and our skills to shape the environment around us. Mm-hmm. And that's the autonomy piece. I guess the opposite would this would be in an organization would certainly be micromanagement. Yeah. The next piece is the G, which is growth. Growth is, as the name implies, growing, moving beyond where we are today into something stronger than we are tomorrow, stronger tomorrow. This is where the swipe really comes into play, because all we're really growing in when we swipe is we grow in swiping. We don't grow in what's in front of us. Mm. And Craig, I can tell from some of the stories that you've told here that it's some of those most difficult times that have actually made you who you are.
Mm,
you
are absolutely.
You are an excellent professional. You understand this. You're a great podcaster, great host there. And it's because you've run into some of these challenges. Well, we swipe past these and we're not growing. Now, a lot of the studies show pretty clearly that today's generation, as well as, you know, subsequent generations and previous generations, would leave a job faster for growth opportunities than anything else. Yet what's really ironic about that is that they're swiping away from growth to move to something they're calling a growth opportunity. So really quite interesting there. The I stands for impact. That is seeing results from your efforts. The opposite of that one would be kind of churning the will. And we refer to that, we'll hopefully talk about that just briefly here in a moment, yeah. The hamster wheel. It's continuing to do something over and over again and not getting results or from our efforts. And that's the I, which is impact. The final one is one we're hearing a lot about today, and that's connection. Connection is a sense of belonging to something greater than just ourselves. And many people find that connection in social connections. You know, maybe I work because I like the people that I work with. By the way, that's one of the highest employee survey question responses is I like the people that I work with. Connection could be a connection to the organization. The company I work for, I believe in the mission. It could be a connection to my work. But there's a reason why I'm here. There's a reason why I'm hanging around. A lot of the suicide research over the last little while has very clearly said to us that an individual will choose to remain here, will choose to be a part of society, will resist the urge for suicide or anything that may come there. If there are two things present, one is I feel like I have a place. There's a reason for me being here. And the second piece is I feel like I'm adding value. I can contribute. And as long as we have that place and the ability to contribute, which is really part of the impact and connection piece, we will choose to engage in what's in front of us. So we realize as we did that study, and this is the basis of some of our previous books together, that doesn't just apply to the workplace. It applies to any organization or any group to which we belong or any task. When those five elements are present to the degree to which we choose to have those present, then we will engage in what's in front of us.
Excellent summary. And I guess without being overly simplistic, whose responsibility is it to create that environment, you know, all those five different things within an organization? Are we talking about, because you know, our audience are in, a lot of them are internal communicators, they're working in employee engagement, organizational development. Is this just something that our leaders just need to understand and be able to deliver? Is this something that, you know, you've talked at the beginning about personal responsibility for all this? Is this something we need to educate our people to see as this is the you know, the formula that we want you to be able to deliver for yourself or be engaged with yourself? How and where does this reside in an organization, or should it reside in an organization?
Well, I'm so glad you brought that up, because that's really kind of at the crux of what we're trying to address here. It is a 50-50 proposition. The organization will own about half of the equation, and the rest of the equation is owned by the individual. Now, the organization can do a couple things. when we run, for example, our organization does lots and lots and lots of employee surveys, hence our large database. And as we do those surveys, we find that when the organization gets those survey results, the top eight people in the organization will sit at the top floor and make some decisions or some edicts for the organization, say, here's how we're going to fix employee engagement. And those eight people don't have the ability to make that happen, speaking quite frankly. And we spend a lot of money trying to make that happen at the top of the organization. If we really want to focus on engagement, it happens at the managerial interaction level. So my manager has the ability to influence a lot of what I feel about with the organization, yet we don't put that onus back on the manager the way it is. I'll give you some examples. When I, as a manager, am engaged in what I do, my employees are 217% more likely to engage in what they do as well. So that impact of the manager is absolutely huge. So when we look at what an organization can do is, yeah, it's great that you set the tone at the top of the organization. Absolutely. The CEO needs to buy into this concept, et cetera. But really where the rubber meets the road is at the manager-employee interaction. Now, the manager cannot say, you will have meaning in your work. But what the manager can do is help the employee understand that there are reasons why we're doing this job. Here's the impact that it has, and here's how you can grow in this, et cetera. But again, it's up to the employee to make those choices.
Excellent. No, I know it's amazing. Well, not amazing. It's for me how many times whatever I talk about on the podcast comes to that relationship between, you know, that person and their manager. It's one of the most fundamental things. It goes back to what I was saying earlier about the, you know, the kind of shift management roles of you know, you can manage there, you can manage anywhere almost, because it's where, you know, performance, high performing organizations have that ability to have managers who can do that, and organizations who struggle, normally that's kind of broken, and it's very simple, but it still amazes me that organizations just don't get it. But you talked about the hamster wheel effect. I'm conscious of time. Let's just go back to that, because again, I always like metaphors. I love the story earlier about the film with a kind of fast forwarding through your life. But let's talk about the hamster wheel effect. And again, I'm familiar with this, but it'd be interesting to know in what context and you talked about it in relationship to the MAGIC acronym. Tell us about the hamster wheel effect.
Well, the metaphor reflects what you think of when you think of being on a hamster wheel, which is just this, this repetitive action that leads nowhere. And that is what we have found people tend to engage in when they are repeatedly swiping. Because the nature of the swipe is that these are typically goals, again, whether they may be related to a job, they may be related to your personal life, or just personal goals, things you've always wanted to achieve. They are things that are typically, if completed, they're beneficial. They're things that are good for us, like, finishing a creative project or getting in shape or that sort of thing. But they're typically also things that on average people try to finish multiple times, following the same patterns over and over again. I mean, I live in the world of books and writing, and I know many, many hundreds and thousands of writers who I've coached and talked with over the years who have talked about the stacks of unfinished manuscripts they have. Now they probably have them on a hard drive. Back in the old days, they would have had a stack of manuscripts in their desk drawer. You know, they get to a certain point, and that page one energy that Tracy talked about kind of dissipates. It trickles away, and they lose focus and they give up. What we have found is there's a fairly predictable pattern of events that occur when people begin this goal process and as they go through it. The most important ones really are what we call first the downhill, which is, as you might expect, the first part of trying something new. It seems fun and easy, partially because it's novel and partially because at the beginning, nothing is really that hard. I mean, you're writing the initial pages of a book, or you're starting a workout, and you're just learning about the different moves and so on. You haven't really put in a ton of effort yet. And it's all interesting and new, and you may have unrealistic or faulty expectations about what's to come. And you may think, wow, I'm starting this workout program in a month. I'm going to be jacked. I'm going to look like The Rock in a month from now. And so we call it the downhill because it's like riding a bike downhill. It's fun. It's easy. You know, the wind's blowing through your hair. This is a piece of cake.
Yeah.
This is great. I love this. And then you hit that all important vertex at the bottom of the hill where you switch to, you start slowly start to go uphill. And now it's work. And that's usually at some point, the time varies depending on what it is you're engaged in. But commonly with some sort of new project or new venture, and I think this applies fairly across the board to writing, to fitness, to weight loss, to learning an instrument or anything like this, or even a new job, where sometime between the 4 and 8 week mark, where you've the newness has worn off, that new car smell is no longer part of the picture, and now you're realizing, maybe my expectations were not congruent with reality here. This is work. This is a lot harder than I thought it was. Results are coming a lot more slowly. If it's a job, wow, there's a lot more to do here, and I don't get to just do whatever I want like I did at my old job. So reality is starting to hit you in the face. And one of the things we found is there's oftentimes a sense of outrage and betrayal at how dare reality step into my fantasy that I was going to write a 400-page novel in 3 months. The nerve of reality to do that. And that is the point at which we reach this crossroads, where when we finally reach the point where, it's an emotional process, but you have to understand, as Tracy alluded to before, the swipe is not a considered intentional thought process. It's not a conscious decision. It is usually a reflexive decision. It's not a decision at all. It's a reflex. It's an instinctive recoiling, what I call hitting the panic button. It's not something you think about doing. So it's, and like most impulses, it's rooted in emotion. So at some point when reality sets in and we're climbing that hill now on the bike and we're huffing and we're puffing and we're sweating and this is hard, this wasn't what I expected, emotions start to come into play. Emotions like self-doubt, embarrassment, disillusionment. A lot of times what I often call a disillusionment event, where you realize, wow, my illusions have been completely shattered. I had no idea what I was getting myself into. Again, self-doubt, embarrassment, things like that. And that's the time where we face that crossroads, which is, do I keep going? Do I push past this? Or do I retreat? Do I run away? Do I hit the eject button in search of something that is more comfortable and is less uncomfortable? It's about lowering discomfort. It's I'm going to stop doing this because going over here and quitting temporarily makes me feel more comfortable. Whew, I'm glad I'm not trying that anymore. That made me feel bad about myself. That made me feel incapable or clumsy or out of shape or untalented or whatever I was feeling about myself. Whew, I'm no longer feeling that. The irony is that most of the time, once that relief fades, the almost universal emotion is regret.
Yeah.
Because these are things that we want to achieve, whether it's being good at our job or being good at our marriage or getting fit and healthy or whatever goal we're trying to pursue. These are beneficial things. And if we could stick with them, we know they would be good for us.
Yeah.
And in the research that I did in talking to a lot of folks who've gone through these experiences, almost universally, they wish they'd stuck with it after the fact.
Yeah.
After they got past that relief of, whew, I'm no longer making a fool of myself, they look back and think, man, if I just stuck with that, I'd be done now. I'd know how to play the piano, or I'd be 25 pounds lighter, whatever the goal was. So that's that hamster wheel process. The what makes it a hamster wheel is unless you do something to arrest that process, it just repeats for the same reasons that you did it the last time, you'll do it the next time.
Yeah. And from my experience, it typically erodes your kind of, it erodes your sort of self value of yourself, but also you develop that kind of, I can't do that sort of thing culture. You know, you hear that, and not only in individuals, but in teams as well. We're not very good at that in this organizing. We're not very good at creativity. Well, why is that? It's because, well, we tried it and it didn't work. And I guess that's kind of,
it can hear that all the time. It contributes to things like imposter syndrome.
Absolutely.
And so on. People start to feel like, as Tracy said, when all you do is the swipe, what you become a master at is quitting.
Yeah.
You don't become a master at what you try, at what you're working on. You master the swipe.
Yeah. Absolutely. I want to bring things to a conclusion, guys, because I could talk about this all day, but that wouldn't be great for the listener. Yeah, absolutely. Unless they're already on car ride. I want to kind of bring things to a conclusion with some sort of, takeaway tips, ideas that the listeners can go away. Obviously, the book, it sounds like the book's where all of this sort of the detailed knowledge of this lies. But let's just sort of wrap things up by, one thing, if you were sort of able to give one tip to someone, it might be might be repeating something we've already kind of alluded to already, but one tip maybe from each of you in terms of, taking the essence of swipe and the concepts within the book and starting to use those ideas to sort of help you to step over or step away from this sort of, if you're trapped in this cycle of, and I am as well. So I'm listening intently to what your tips are of starting things and not finishing them and feeling frustrated about that.
Well, I think the book itself is about how to overcome that swipe. And so there are lots of things here, but as we are writing this, there's one piece that was really impactful for me. It continues to be impactful. Mm. And that is, we call this recognize and reflect. Recognize when I'm about to swipe. Recognize that this action that I'm taking right now is a swipe. It's me moving from something uncomfortable that will help me grow and move forward to something more comfortable. So I think that was the thing that, as I look at what's most impactful in the research for me, was recognize that what is in front of me and what I'm doing is a swipe.
Excellent. And see it for what it is. I like that. And be tuned into that. And that was you, Tracy, wasn't it? Yeah. Tim, what about yourself?
Sure. Well, there are two things that are interconnected that I want to leave your listeners with. They're really the primary movers of swiping that I think if people start to recognize before they take something on, they can reduce their chances of quitting. One is understanding their motivation. So as you're about to take on a goal, you're about to embark on whatever the journey is, why are you doing it? Are your motivations valid? Are they your motivations, more to the point? So are you doing this thing, taking on this extraordinary thing because the fire's in your belly to do it, because this is something you really want to do? Or are you doing it out of, fear of missing out or envy or pressure from someone else, or just because you think, well, I should write a novel because that's what people do? Faulty motivations leave you high and dry when the time comes to deal with difficulty. And the second thing is looking at your expectations. What are your expectations for the experience? That really falls into two categories. What are your expectations for what the experience will be like? And what are your expectations for the results? And both of those sets of expectations need to be realistic. Achieving things, important things, is hard work. So whatever you're doing is probably not going to be easy. And what are the results going to be? Results take time. They don't necessarily come at a steady pace. Sometimes they come in bursts. So I think if people can start to look at their motivation and expectations before they start to go after a goal, they can reduce their risk of swiping.
Mm, excellent. Well, look, that's been absolutely fantastic. So the book is, tell me when the book is coming out. I think it's imminent, but
it comes out March 21st, so in less than a week.
March 21st. So yeah, at the time of recording. So this is going to be going out probably maybe a week or two after it's been published. So people will put a link in the show notes to this, but it's the book is called just called Swipe. Yeah.
Yeah.
And yeah, with the subtext of the science behind why we don't finish what we start. And that's available on all at all good bookshops. We won't mention any names for fear of being accused of promoting them, but I guess we probably all imagine where that might be.
Yeah.
Look, that's been fantastic, guys. Thank you so much. Really enjoyed that conversation. Thanks, Pete. Lots of really interesting thoughts, and it's really provoked me into thinking about, you know, me catching myself swiping and being aware of that and not taking the easy route sometimes. I don't think I've ever been someone who's taken easy routes, but I think I still do catch myself going down those easy alleyways sometimes when there's a more rich but a slightly longer and bumpier path that I should really be taking. So that's been fantastic. Well, thank you so much, guys. All the best with the book launch, and I'll be looking forward to keeping in touch with you after the book goes out. And I'm sure, you know, we'll be finding out how it's going, and wish you every success with it. And anything I can do to help you with that, let me know.
A pleasure. Thank you,
Craig. It's been a pleasure. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much. Bye bye. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Engaging Internal Comms podcast. If you've got any ideas for episodes you'd like us to cover in future, you can email us at info@thebigpicturepeople.co.uk, or you can use the feedback form at engagingic.com. If you're not already subscribed to the show via your podcast platform, please do so. And if you could leave a review for us, that would be absolutely fantastic. We have links to other episodes at engagingic.com. All of our previous episodes are available there. And if you're interested in our visual communication services, our big pictures, our learning maps, our explainer videos, and also our live graphic recording, please get in touch with us again at info@thebigpicturepeople.co.uk. Thank you.